This is tongue in cheek.
So, I'd like to start.
Woo! Not so fast.
Let's all take a deep breath down.
Down?
Down.
Down.
Let it out, just as you do. So, one of the first things that people tend to teach when they're teaching any kind of vocal performance, whether that's public speaking, whether that's singing, whether that's oratorical performance, is what is called diaphragmatic breathing. But I always find that to be really funny, because diaphragmatic breathing is like saying foot walking. It's what we do usually when we breathe. And it's only when we're told to take a deep breath in that we start breathing up and lifting our shoulders and doing all these other crazy things that restrict our voice. So I always tell my students to start by taking a deep breath down. And if you really want to focus on the diaphragm, there's two ways that we can start to look at that. And one is to take your palm and put the center of your palm right on your belly button. This is the most common one.
Should we sit or stand?
You can sit, but sit up. And make sure that your thumb is kind of at the bottom of your sternum and your pinky is down around your belt buckle or where it would be. And then take a deep breath down, trying to feel your breath actually pushing into your hand, not just pushing your six packs out. Let's take a deep breath down. Now, another way we can do that is to wrap our thumbs around the bottom of our rib cage so that our pinkies are touching our ribs in the back and our forefingers are kind of pointing towards our belt. And so let's take another deep breath down, pushing into our palms. And let that one out. And it can also help to do a bit of controlled breathing. So let's let it out this time we'll take a deep breath all in together and let it out on a count just of eight, maybe. That's under it. Mm-hmm. Deep breath down. And one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. All right, let's try that one more time. This time, let's give it a count of 32. And as we're breathing out, let's just, for the listeners, give a little bit of a shh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
On the exhale?
Yeah, on the exhale. So a deep breath down, ready? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, two, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, three, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, four, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
Were we supposed to breathe out that whole time?
Yeah.
Oh, see, okay.
No, but that's part of the, it's set up to fail. And in the failure itself, you'll probably start to feel a lot of things constricting in your torso. Mm. And exactly that constriction that you're generally feeling behind your superficial abdominal muscles, you're feeling next to your stomach, that's actually your diaphragm being really tired and pushing really hard.
Mm.
And so one of the best ways I find to find your diaphragm, to actually discover this muscle that's sitting below your lungs and allowing these muscle-less vacuum bags to function, is to really overwork them. And one way is just to breathe. Usually for people who are not like trained opera singers or something, 32 counts is enough to get them to be like, hey, what?
Stutter.
And right. And I saw it in each of your faces, like, what are we still
how
really
32?
Nil? No, we're not done.
But so can I ask something quick?
Of course.
Between the breathing down, where, as you said, our diaphragm is in motion and is moving, but it's our breath, like you said, that we should feel pulling out when we kept our palm on our belly button and our pinky towards our belt. How is that? That's in some ways the reverse. One is inhale, where that's, and the reverse is the exhale, this prolonged exhale. So how is the diaphragm working differently in that?
So the diaphragm is a muscle that pushes straight down. And what you're actually feeling, if you're feeling your quote-unquote your breath, pushing your ribs out, you're actually feeling like your guts, your viscera, your stomach, your intestines being pushed out of the way by your diaphragm.
Wow.
So there's this idea that if we're taking a real deep breath, we're like filling our torsos with air, but really we're just pushing the diaphragm down enough that our other guts get pushed in funny different places. Because we don't have any muscles in our lungs.
Mm.
So the only way we breathe in is to move other things out of the way.
Wow.
And the diaphragm is the muscle that's dedicated to doing that. But as we all know, if we've been to the doctor, we can also kind of lift our shoulders up. And that's really good if you're trying to like hear whether you have tuberculosis. But it's not very good for supporting your voice over a long period of time.
Can we do that 32 count again?
Yeah, I love that. Can we, so around here or wrapped around or in the front, whichever is easier for you.
You mean our hands?
Yeah, sorry.
either in the front with our palm.
Palm over the belly button.
Palm over the belly button. Thumb up towards the sternum.
Towards the sternum. Finger right around the belly button.
Pinky pointed down to the, or touching the belt.
Or thumbs wrapped around the front of the rib cage. Pinkies around the back of the bottom of the rib cage.
Mm-hmm.
And fingers kind of right where your hip bones meet your belt.
Mm-hmm. I like to think about this as, or at least having your hands around this way, as if you were to, if you were in the woods somewhere and you were to grab the trunk of a tree forward with your two hands, as if before you were hugging it, but you're just sort of wrap your two hands around it, and then you were to able to turn that whole tree upside down, well, then you could understand that your feet are actually the leaves and your head is the roots.
Absolutely, and that's why we call this the trunk.
Okay, so...
So, Tree Huggers Anonymous. yeah, so let's take a deep breath down into our palms, wherever they may be. And one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, three, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, four, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
It's too long.
You'll get there. And it's always funny for me. I tell my students that, like, particularly at Roger Williams, I teach a lot of students who are Division III athletes and are not into breathing exercises. And it can sometimes help to talk of it like your diaphragm is a muscle, just like your biceps, just like your quads. And by working it out, you can gain a lot more control over it. You can do a lot more things with it, and you can become, in very understandable ways, you can make it bigger and stronger.
Yes.
So Timmy's moving us along by playing some real rockin' 15th century German music there. That's a piece called Will Niemand Singen, which means, does nobody want to sing? Is nobody going to sing? Which is often how I feel when I'm doing these vocal exercises for the first time. With some of my students, it's really a different way of using their bodies. And it makes some people really uncomfortable to feel parts of their body that they've never really felt before, to feel their guts moving around and to think about that as being what's happening. And so just this week, I started doing some of these exercises with my students down at Roger Williams. And yeah, the face on that they make when I ask them to breathe for the 32 seconds, I mean... the faces that you were making as well, but
it's so interesting though that athletes wouldn't be interested in this, because I feel like at a certain level of performance, this is, you know, the stabilization of your torso with breath is like an incredibly important thing. I mean, I know like in powerlifting and sure. a lot of things where you have to stabilize your core, inflating it with air actually makes it more rigid.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, of course, when you run and you land, you know, every time your foot falls, you're sharply compressing your torso and, you know, coordinating your breaths in and out with how your feet are falling is another thing that a lot of elite athletes have to think about.
Yeah. And I get a lot of pushback, actually, from runners, because depending on what style of running you're doing, it can actually be really important to breathe up, particularly for certain sprints, for certain kinds of long-distance running. So sometimes I get these runners in my classes who say, no, I've been taught runners and also swimmers because you want that buoyancy in the top.
Buoyancy. That's something I didn't even think about.
Right.
Can you give us a little context here of how you came about teaching these courses, what the courses are that we're speaking to at Roger Williams? And it sounds like the first exercise that you started us off with is sort of emulative of the beginning of one of these courses.
Yeah. But
maybe a larger background on, for you personally, how you came about these exercises, both in sort of professionally within your performing, like as a performer.
Yeah.
And then second to that, which is a context I know, but I'd love for you to share of being in a program at Brown and starting to work with Barbara Tenenbaum.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe I'll start with Barbara Tenenbaum and work backwards. Barbara Tenenbaum is a public speaking teacher, public speaking coach who has worked at Brown for her whole career, but also consults nationally, internationally. I think her bio says that she's worked on 6 continents out of 7. And she's gunning for that last one. But
What's the last one?
You'd think it was Antarctica, but...
But it's not.
as a student in the doctoral program at Brown University in the theater and performance studies doctoral program, a lot of us get the opportunity to teach with her and then sometimes to take her course and put our own spin on it.
And what's this course called?
And it's called Persuasive Communication. And the course is really about speaking to your audience, which sounds obvious. Audience-centered communication, anticipating what your audience wants to hear, anticipating where your audience is at and where they're coming from, and tailoring what you have to say to that particular group, which seems so obvious as soon as you put it out, but in the actual practice is quite difficult. And it's surprising as soon as you start thinking about audience-centered communication, how much communication you hear from day to day that is not that way.
So it's focusing more on the act of communication than the content of communication and the circumstances surrounding it and the relationships that it's actually enacting, not describing.
Definitely. And even in terms of the content, really thinking about forming the content in such a way that it is approachable to that audience, whether that means reorganizing the structure, approaching some things first and holding off on some other points. Or even from a more argumentative standpoint, we do spend a lot of time in rhetorical theory. Just what arguments are going to be persuasive to this audience that are not necessarily persuasive to...
I feel like that'd be a really valuable course in law school or something.
Yeah.
In particular. Politics and law.
Has she taught... She's taught sort of across... I mean, what are the kinds of students in this class? They are from...
A huge cross-section. Yeah, so from across the university. There's not a law school at Brown. But really, I've taught bioengineers. I've taught actors. I've taught computers, a lot of computer scientists, a lot of future finance people, a lot of future lawyers. One of my students actually just got accepted to the law school, and so inevitably the students go
in many different ways. Can you Can you give us an exercise before we get into a little bit more of the context around?
Yeah.
First, this exercise that you started us off with, is that something that you would normally teach in that class? Because that first exercise was from a class at Roger Williams, right?
So that's an exercise I do
in both.
And it's something I do in the first week or so with my students in persuasive communication. It's something I kind of hold off with my students at Roger Williams for a few weeks just because of the structure of the course. Mm. And when so at Roger Williams, I do it when we're first starting to talk about music, and I do a kind of one-day crash course in Western music theory, mm-hmm. which is insane. And for me, I find that thinking about music through your body, actually breathing into it very literally, can be a great way for students who might have heard the words rhythm and harmony, melody, and don't necessarily know what the difference between those words mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. And it was remarkable for me, coming from a lot of musical training throughout my life, that these words were not kind of self-evident. But that's one of the joys of teaching, I think, that you learn that the things that you've completely assimilated are things that are not fully differentiated in the same way.
So these are, in some ways, they're physicalizing music internally yeah. that they understood externally. And it sounds like that maybe in a similar way, when we're thinking about this breathing, like this form of being aware of your diaphragm as understanding that when we breathe in, we are negotiating space within our own body, like moving yeah. stuff around in order for breath to be pulled in. We can also think maybe about rhetoric in a similar way, mm-hmm. but externally, that our rhetoric or our speaking is a sort of expiration into the world, trying to renegotiate people and things in order for your breath to become there. I mean, yeah. that's maybe, but I don't know, it just comes to mind in thinking about that exercise. Is there, since we did do this internal, mm-hmm. can you bring us to some exercise that is maybe closer to how people would think of rhetoric, or how you end up teaching rhetoric in this Barbara Tannenbaum inspired course, or this lineage of Barbara Tannenbaum?
Yeah, I actually want to do an exercise that you talked about earlier this morning when you were having your coffee.
Yeah.
Because I think it really brings us to this idea of externalizing mm. this internal sensation.
Mm. That you'd say as rhetoric or no?
That I would say as rhetoric, yeah. I mean, I think the important thing for me to get across to my students, especially in the first few weeks, is this idea, and I mentioned this in our first talks, about listening as you speak. Mm. And it's something that that for me has been really important throughout my life, but also that is one of these things I find to be self-evident to me, but obscure mm. as soon as I try to vocalize it. Mm. And I talk about it with my students by saying, like, right now, I'm the one who's talking. You're literally paying me to stand here and to talk to you. But I'm looking out around at all of your faces, and I can see who's listening, and I can see who hasn't had their coffee this morning, and I can see who is getting a text from their girlfriend or their person of any kind, and is feeling that buzz, and all of these pieces of information are creating a tapestry of mm. of not just information abstractly, of kind of feeling that I am responding to as mm. I'm talking, that change my rhythm, that change my breathing. Mm. And by responding in those ways, I can stay there in the room with you in a very different way than if I was just spouting off or reading from a script whatever I had prepared to say. Mm-hmm. So what Timmy had suggested earlier was maybe a version of a game that some of us played as children that we won't mention the name of, but it's so we'll start with a slightly different version of it just to get ourselves great. Back to our diaphragms.
And just to tie it to before, is this something that you would do?
This is similar to something I would do in class. Great. So the first part is something I would do. And for anyone listening in, it might get a little bit loud. Mm-hmm. So finding your hands either wrapped around your back or over your belly button.
Again, sitting on the edge of your chair.
Sitting
standing
on the edge of your chair.
Or however you can.
Really pulling your back as straight as possible. And one thing we suggest is to imagine a string. This is, again, a really common kind of way of thinking in theater practice, in dance as well. Thinking of a string going from your coccyx, from the little tailbone at the base of your spine, straight up through your head, up into the ceiling, and sort of dangling from that string, letting your whole body weight kind of fall down, letting your spine support your body. And so we're going to breathe down, and at first we're just going to laugh. And it'll be forced, I know, but then we'll get there. So we're just going to take a deep breath down. The thing about if you listen to it laughing, you inevitably, it's like a little more contagious than yawning.
Are we supposed to laugh just on the exhale?
Well, you can laugh however you need to laugh.
This is only contagious for Dan.
Maybe just me trolling myself.
I only laugh at my own jokes.
So when we're laughing, almost naturally, we're really pumping our diaphragms. And so now we're going to do a sort of more controlled laugh. And for this one, I do find it really helpful to have my palm over my navel to really feel that action.
Can I stand?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we can take, when you're ready, we can take a deep breath down. And then we're going to let it out on huh, huh, hey.
Huh, huh, hey.
This time we're going to say huh, huh, hooray.
Huh, huh, hooray.
Now, I'd like us to find a point in the room to look at. There's a series of Polaroids here on the wall. If you want to find somebody in the Polaroids to direct your laughter at,
don't look at yourself, Darren.
And so, if you can point with your finger, point at that Polaroid as you say, "Huh, huh, hey." Ready? A deep breath down. And huh, 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 hey. And so we begin to start to think about directing our voice, projecting it out to a specific point in space. And as soon as we start thinking about pointing to the wall, we can start thinking about pointing through the wall and listening to the resonance come back. But instead of going in that direction, I'd like to find this exercise that Timmy had suggested earlier. And so we're just going to play a game. And using our diaphragms just like that, We're going to try to start off by saying, hey, as softly as possible and as short as possible. And then
after an exhale.
So we're going to take a deep inhale. And then throughout the course of the exhale, we're going to try to see as loud as we can get before we run out of exhale.
Mm-hmm. So we're sort of hucketing back and forth between Aaron and I. Are you going to be a part?
I'll jump in if I...
Okay, so it's Aaron and I. We're going to switch off. So we take a big inhale, and then a really soft. But maybe alternating.
I think you can decide whether and maybe the three of us can do it. I think it'd be good to have that kind of dynamic.
Okay.
So we'll kind of not know where the next one's coming from.
All right, but it's all on one exhale.
Let's try it all on one exhale. See how that works.
Okay. Yeah. Hey. Next breath in.
Sure. You want to try it again?
So I'm moving from soft to loud.
Hey.
This is all in one breath.
So, Dan, these exercises in persuasive communication, rhetoric, oratory, both at Brown and Roger Williams that you've been doing for the past six or seven years, is only really a part of you. It's maybe 1/3 of you or 1/17 of you or something.
Something like that.
There's one other part of you that's a major reason why I thought it would be wonderful to have you on, which is the research that you've been doing, particularly into 16th century French, essentially like forms of truth telling or historical tellings of royal processions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I kind of was just thinking about that. I mean, another way of sort of describing, or I'd love to get into thinking about your research, is in the deferral or reflection of voice, when voice happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, just in this exercise, when we were like pointing hey, and we pointed to this Polaroid on the wall. And then we spoke about, well, what happens when voice comes back?
Yeah.
It's strange that we think so, it's so obvious to us in a certain way that our voices and sound bounce around in a room, and very little, much less often do we think about our voices bouncing around in history.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's sort of like an interesting, either speaking to the piece of music that I just played and I can play again, or just going straight into hearing a little bit about your research would be great.
Sure. So maybe going in a couple of ways, this idea of our voices bouncing around the room, it's just a really interesting thing to think about here in this room, as in any radio station, where the entire construction of the room is designed to have as little resonance as possible, to let your voice bounce as little as possible, to contain the sound. So that as much as possible is really focused on these microphones and coming through these earphones. And it's really a remarkable shift in the way that we think about our voice and the way that voices have been thought about, not only in public speaking, but also particularly in architecture.
Mm.
Because you had to build rooms that people could hear other people in. Mm-hmm. And one thing we heard when I play this particular piece for my Roger Williams students, a lot of them talk about, I ask them where they think it is from. And a lot of them say, oh, well, it sounds like it's in a church. And at a certain level, that's probably true, because I know this band and they perform in churches and they probably like performed in a church. And you can hear really the resonance of the space, these voices echoing as well as blending. And that's really built into these old Gothic cathedrals, mm-hmm. into the neo-Gothic buildings even in the U.S. in ways that really it disturbs me to go to church services today and see the little wireless mics. Because you're really not feeling the space.
But I want to keep you on in terms of your research within the time that we have.
Right. And so the piece also, it's called the Triunfo di Bacco. And the reason that it's funny for me, for them thinking of it being in a church, is because it's the triumph of Bacchus, who is the god of wine and the god of theater and the god of partying and bacchanals. And I can almost certainly think that this piece would not have been performed in this sort of slow, kind of like luxurious way.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been upbeat. People would have been drunk
on the street
out there
in casual procession
or falling out of a bar and or falling out of the courtroom, whatever it is, but falling out of their
cells,
their tops, their yep. in different ways. And I think it tells me a lot about the way that the 16th century, or in this case the late 15th century, has been received. The triumph of Bacchus is part of this long tradition of rethinking a ceremony called the Roman Triumph, which was a celebration for generals who had succeeded greatly in battle and then were returning to Rome. And if the Senate decided that it was legitimate, they would get to have a triumph. And this trope of the triumph of Bacchus is sort of an inversion of that. It's like Bacchus who fights only by like confusing people and getting them drunk and making them fall over, has this triumph. And you see it throughout a number of pieces in visual culture, particularly sarcophagi for some reason.
This trope of the triumph.
Of the triumph of Bacchus.
But just to be hyper clear, what was the thing it's sort of perverting, the triumph?
The triumph is like the celebration of the Roman general or the mm-hmm. imperator.
In a procession. That would move within one place, move between cities.
So literally, the Roman triumphs, at least the early ones, would all happen in Rome, and they were actually just a way of displaying the amount of booty or the amount of trophies that were captured in a battle, in a campaign. So you would destroy another city, and then you would bring that city back to Rome.
Right.
So where would it go from within Rome to within Rome?
Sometimes it would become a triumphal arch that you would have a procession go through, right? What was that?
There's a lot of debate among classicists about whether anybody walked through an arch. there's a whole literature about whether people ever go through the arches or past the arches, and whether the arch is like a decorated gate or whether it's a freestanding structure.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the most persuasive, because I guess I've read a lot of this, some of the most persuasive materials say that it has always been a freestanding structure.
Mm.
It has always been a sort of absurdity,
mm-hmm.
that you've built this gate that nobody goes through, that nobody really, that you always kind of pass by, and yet accrues in very literal cases, because you would hang trophies on it. Trophies are, in the classical sense, trophies are like actual armor that you took off people that you killed.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in classical architecture, you'll see carvings of like armor without bodies in it, and that's trophy.
Mm. So, I mean, on this note of these empty armors, mm-hmm. or these triumphal arches that are it almost doesn't matter if somebody walked through or not.
Yeah.
If I am sort of projecting how I think you have been thinking in your research, can we get towards the 16th century documents that maybe you can sort of illustrate with one example of a document that you looked at in a particular way? So the 16th century account of one of these triumphal marches.
Yeah. So one piece that I looked at a lot was a festival that took place in 1600 in Avignon to celebrate the arrival of Marie de Medici, who was Henry IV's second wife. And she sort of was like, Henry IV had another wife, Marguerite de Navarre, or Marguerite Valois, and decided that he needed a new one because he just taken over the throne of France, and he found a rich Italian Medici and brought her in, and he kept telling her that he was going to meet her at these different cities in Marseille and then Aix and then Avignon, and he kept coming up with reasons that he couldn't get there. So this is a festival that was designed for Henry IV, but Henry IV didn't show up. And so it became a festival about Henry IV, about the image, or in the terms of its conceiver, the genius, which is a word that goes back to this idea of a jinn or a genie, this sort of Eastern, Middle Eastern spirit. Mm-hmm. So the genius of Henry IV was celebrated there in lieu of his actual presence.
But in an actual performance.
In an actual performance. So then one image that I've looked at a lot is this triumphal cart, which is supposed to portray Henry and his wife Marie processing in triumph through the city of Avignon, which at that point was still part of the Papal Roman States, and pulled by these elephants, and elephants were considered to be like one of the peak things you could demonstrate at a triumph. If you captured elephants, it goes
especially
back to this,
two of them.
Yeah. Especially two of them. It goes back to this Roman fear of Hannibal and the elephants. So there's this gorgeous image that maybe we can take a chance to drive at of these two elephants pulling this cart that is filled with musicians and has Marie and Henry at the top in the triumphal seat. But as we know from various reasons, including the description that is in the same book on the next page, the musician Henry was not there, first of all. Marie was there watching the festival, but she was not on the cart. And so she was looking at somebody impersonating herself, looking at somebody impersonating her absent husband. And then it says also that the musicians were so worried that they weren't going to catch up in time to be in the procession that they had to take the elephant costumes off of their horses and run the chariot ahead. So
we have like three things here, right? We have a print or a drawing.
Mm-hmm.
We have the performance having happened,
mm-hmm.
or the triumphal march, and we have then a text that is describing what has happened, or maybe what will happen within this within the actual performance. I wonder if you can sort of just rechart between these three things for us at a remove, saying how you are thinking about these three elements in time and truth making, or
whatever. So especially because there's sort of this elaborate image and then a text right next to it that says the image is not true. Sometimes the texts are more removed, but a lot of scholars of this genre of book and a lot of scholars of festivals have just sort of said, okay, well, like the books are all kind of lies. Their propaganda, and we're just supposed to think that things were really great when they weren't. And for me, that's a really unproductive and uninteresting line, mm-hmm. of argument. And I'm really interested in what the stakes are of knowing that something didn't happen, allowing us all to know that something didn't happen, and still portraying it in as much rich detail as possible. Mm-hmm. In such a way that, for me, when I look at this image, when I look at the elephant's eyes, the elephants themselves are reaching out and are kind of seducing me.
Mm-hmm. But this, an image like this, to from what I understand of how you're thinking, an image like this is not just in detail and in precision of detail. It is actually emulating something else. Yeah. It's echoing and borrowing something, right? In its representing of something else. So I wonder, like, what are other examples of this kind of borrowing that starts to that we don't necessarily just approach into, like, in seeing, well, this is phony and this is like a lie, but that where one text or one historical account of something is literally ventriloquizing, like using the voice of something else to speak through it.
Yeah, so one of the ways I got into this project was thinking about the idea of classical creative imitation, which is this notion that particularly poets, is the way that it's usually been thought, would borrow lines or stanzas or chunks of other people's poems as citations, sort of as kind of a flex, like, look at how much I've read. But what was really interesting to me is when this started to be seen not only in poets and quote-unquote artists, but also in historians. So seeing historians actually borrow passages from other historians to describe completely different historical events, but then these passages would be repurposed, and the idea was not actually to approach the quote-unquote what really happened with more precision, but to evoke it in more detail, in more affective, with more affective weight for the person who was listening to it, or in the case of these etchings, or these engravings, pardon me, for the person who's looking at it, often also in texts for the person who's reading it.
This is the basis of ekphrasis.
Mm-hmm.
Can you define ekphrasis in that, under those terms?
Sure. So many of us might have heard of ekphrasis as being a very detailed description of something that we see. But historically, in the history of rhetoric, it's about bringing something before the eyes of the audience, before the eyes of the listener, and making it present, making something that is absent present. So for me, looking at this picture of the elephants, what's important is not whether those elephants were really there on that day. And that's not important to me, but I think it's also not important to anyone who was at that festival. The important thing is that each time that this festival is retold or redepicted, it can more approach a non-static ideal, a kind of virtual idea of what the festival can be.
An emergent.
Right. Yeah.
And probable.
And probable.
And I mean, that's maybe going in a different direction.
Yeah. Well, it becomes more, it becomes not more truthful, not more verifiable, but more verisimilar. And as we talked, the history of probability is linguistically tied up with the history of verisimilitude. So verisimilitas is what Pascal talked about when he developed the mathematics of probability, what Leibniz talked about. And also going back, what Augustine talked about. And we have this concurrent idea of probability throughout the history of rhetoric. But really we're thinking about how through these iterations we create a truth that we are gradually approaching closer and closer.
Thank you.
we'll start. So there are two elephants pulling a cart, extremely ornate cart, full of what look like partying or celebrating figures.
All right, but bring it to us. Like, how are you going to get us to see it?
Okay, yeah, this isn't very
What's
good
exciting
exercise.
About it? No, but that's the process.
Well, the cart is led by this triumphant-looking figure. It looks like a woman holding a very ornate staff and a crown and a heart in what looks like a heart in one hand.
And the heart is leading the cart.
It's at the very front of the cart before the elephants are there. And then at the back are these two also very triumphant-looking figures holding a sword with a crown on it.
Assertive and relaxed.
Yes. And then these sort of gargoyle-like figures around the back edges of the cart.
What's the most striking thing to you about this image? Where do your eyes go first?
The two wheels. There's only two wheels, and they're two elephants. They're two elephants pulling this huge boat of a cart that's highly elevated on these two wheels, as if it's just going in one direction. And a shadow that's on beneath the whole cart that sort of shows that there's only two wheels.
Mm. And where is the cart going?
The cart is just moving along. It's triumphantly moving along into nowhere.
Yeah, it's just floating in space. It's not. It doesn't have context.
Could be everywhere and anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's always been striking to me about these books. That kind of decontextualization of the things.
Yeah, I mean that's sort of I think is interesting about what you were saying with the festival. Once it happens more and more, that it can become this sort of timeless, placeless thing that can be filled and refilled with meaning by anyone who can access it.
Yeah, even you.
Really?